I'm not sure I can explain them very well, but they're important things I can't go on avoiding any longer. Still, you shouldn't feel that I'm a burden to you. The one thing I don't want to be is a burden to anyone. I can sense the good feelings you have for me. They make me very happy. All I am doing in this letter is trying to convey that happiness to you. Those good feelings of yours are probably just what I need at this point in my life. Please forgive me if anything I've written here upsets you. As I said before, I am a far more flawed human being than you realize. I sometimes wonder, if you and I had met under absolutely ordinary circumstances, and if we had liked each other, what would have happened? If I had been normal and you had been normal, which of course you are, and there had been no Kizuki, what would have happened? Of course, this if is way too big. I'm trying hard at least to be fair and honest. It's all I can do at this point. I hope to convey some small part of my feelings to you this way. Unlike an ordinary hospital, this place has free visiting hours. As long as you call the day before, you can come any time. You can even eat with me, and there's a place for you to stay. Please come and see me sometime when it's convenient for you. I look forward to seeing you. I'm enclosing a map. Sorry this turned into such a long letter. I read Naoko's letter all the way through, and then I read it again. After that, I went downstairs, bought a Coke from the vending machine, and drank it while reading the letter one more time. I put the 7 pages of writing paper back into the envelope and laid it on my desk. My name and address had been written on the pink envelope in perfect tiny characters that were just a bit too precisely formed for those of a girl. I sat at my desk, studying the envelope. The return address on the back said Ami Hostel. An odd name. I thought about it for a few minutes, concluding that the Ami must be from the French word for friend. After putting the letter away in my desk drawer, I changed clothes and went out. I was afraid that if I stayed near the letter, I would end up reading it 10, 20, who knew how many times. I walked the streets of Tokyo on Sunday without a destination in mind, as I had always done with Naoko. I wandered from one street to the next, recalling her letter line by line, and mulling each sentence over as best I could. When the sun went down, I returned to the dorm and made a long-distance call to the Ami Hostel. A woman receptionist answered and asked my business. I asked if it might be possible for me to visit Naoko the following afternoon. I left my name, and she said I should call back in half an hour. The same woman answered when I called back after dinner. It would indeed be possible for me to see Naoko, she said. I thanked her, hung up, and put a change of clothes and a few toiletries in my rucksack. Then I picked up the Magic Mountain again, reading and sipping brandy, and waiting to get sleepy. Even so, I didn't fall asleep until after 1 o'clock in the morning. Chapter 6. As soon as I woke at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, I washed my face, shaved, and went straight to the dorm head's room without eating breakfast to say that I was going to be gone for 2 days hiking in the hills. He was used to my taking short trips when I had free time, and reacted without surprise. I took a crowded commuter train to Tokyo Station and bought a bullet train ticket to Kyoto, literally jumping onto the first Hikari Express to pull out. I made do with coffee and a sandwich for breakfast and dozed for an hour. I arrived in Kyoto a few minutes before 11. Following Naoko's instructions, I took a city bus to a small terminal serving the northern suburbs. The next bus to my destination would not be leaving until 11:35, I was told, and the trip would take a little over an hour. I bought a ticket and went to a bookshop across the street for a map. Back in the waiting room, I studied the map to see if I could find exactly where the Ami Hostel was located. It turned out to be much farther into the mountains than I had imagined. The bus would have to cross several hills in its trek north, then turn around where the canyon road dead-ended and return to the city. My stop would be just before the end of the line. There was a footpath near the bus stop, according to Naoko, and if I followed it for 20 minutes I would reach Ami Hostel. No wonder it was such a quiet place, if it was that deep in the mountains. The bus pulled out with about 20 passengers aboard, following the Kamo River through the north end of Kyoto. The tightly packed city streets gave way to more sparse housing, then fields and vacant land. Black tile roofs and vinyl-sided greenhouses caught the early autumn sun and sent it back with a glare. When the bus entered the canyon, the driver began hauling the steering wheel this way and that to follow the twists and curves of the road, and I began to feel queasy. I could still taste my morning coffee. By the time the number of curves began to decrease to the point where I felt some relief, the bus plunged into a chilling cedar forest. The trees might have been old growth, the way they towered over the road, blocking out the sun and covering everything in gloomy shadows. The breeze flowing into the bus's open windows turned suddenly cold, its dampness sharp against the skin. The valley road hugged the riverbank. Continuing so long through the trees, it began to seem as if the whole world had been buried forever in cedar forest. At which point the forest ended, and we came to an open basin surrounded by mountain peaks. Broad green farmland spread out in all directions, and the river by the road looked bright and clear. A single thread of white smoke rose in the distance. Some houses had laundry drying in the sun, and dogs were howling. Each farmhouse had firewood out front piled up to the eaves, usually with a cat resting somewhere on the pile. The road was lined with such houses for a time, but I saw not a single person. The scenery repeated this pattern any number of times. The bus would enter Cedar Forest, come out to a village, then go back into forest. It would stop at a village to let people off, but no one ever got on. 40 minutes after leaving the city, the bus reached a mountain pass with a wide open view. The driver stopped the bus and announced that we would be waiting there for 5 or 6 minutes. People could step down from the bus if they wished. There were only 4 passengers left now, including me. We all got out and stretched or smoked, and looked down at the panorama of Kyoto far below. The driver went off to one side for a pee. A sun-tanned man in his early 50s, who had boarded the bus with a big rope-tied cardboard carton, asked me if I was going out to hike in the mountains. I said yes, to keep things simple. Eventually another bus came climbing up from the other side of the pass and stopped next to ours. The driver got out, had a short talk with our driver, and the 2 men climbed back into their buses. The 4 of us returned to our seats, and the buses pulled out in opposite directions. It was not immediately clear to me why our bus had had to wait for the other one, but a short way down the other side of the mountain, the road narrowed suddenly. 2 big buses could never have passed each other on the road. And in fact, passing ordinary cars coming in the other direction required a good deal of maneuvering, with one or the other vehicle having to back up and squeeze into the overhang of a curve. The villages along the road were far smaller now, and the level areas under cultivation even narrower. The mountain was steeper, its walls pressed closer to the bus windows. They seemed to have just as many dogs as the other places, though, and the arrival of the bus would set off a howling competition. At the stop where I got off, there was nothing. No houses, no fields, just the bus stop sign, a little stream, and the trail opening. I slung my rucksack over my shoulder and started up the track. The stream ran along the left side of the trail, and a forest of deciduous trees lined the right. I had been climbing the gentle slope for some 15 minutes when I came to a road leading into the woods on the right, the opening barely wide enough to accommodate a car. Ami Hostel, private, no trespassing, read the sign by the road. Sharply etched tire tracks ran up the road through the trees. The occasional flapping of wings echoed in the woods. The sound came through with strange clarity, as if amplified above the other voices of the forest. Once, from far away, I heard what might have been a rifle shot. But it was a small and muffled sound, as though it had passed through several filters. Beyond the woods I came to a white stone wall. It was no higher than my own height, and, lacking additional barriers on top, would have been easy for me to scale. The black iron gate looked sturdy enough, but it was wide open, and there was no one manning the guardhouse. Another sign like the last one stood by the gate. Ami Hostel, private, no trespassing. A few clues suggested the guard had been there until some moments before. The ashtray held three butt ends, a teacup stood there half empty, a transistor radio sat on a shelf, and the clock on the wall ticked off the time with a dry sound. I waited a while for the person to come back, but when that showed no sign of happening, I gave a few pushes to something that looked as if it might be a bell. The area just inside the gate was a car park. In it stood a minibus, a four-wheel drive Land Cruiser, and a dark blue Volvo. The car park could have held 30 cars, but only those three were parked there now. 2 or 3 minutes went by, and then a gatekeeper in a navy blue uniform came down the forest road on a yellow bicycle. He was a tall man in his early 60s with receding hair. He leaned the yellow bike against the guardhouse and said, "I'm very sorry to have kept you waiting." Though he didn't sound sorry at all. The number 32 was painted in white on the bike's mudguard. When I gave him my name, he picked up the phone and repeated it twice to someone on the other end. Replied, "Yes. Uh-huh. I see." To the other person, then hung up. "Go to the main building, please, and ask for Dr. Ishida," he said to me. "You take this road through the trees to a roundabout. Then take your second left. Got that? Your second left from the roundabout. You'll see an old house. Turn right and go through another bunch of trees to a concrete building. That's the main building. It's easy. Just watch for the signs." I took the second left from the roundabout as instructed, and where that path ended, I came to an interesting old building that obviously had been someone's country house once. It had a manicured garden with well-shaped rocks and a stone lantern. It must have been a country estate. Turning right through the trees, I saw a three-story concrete building. It stood in a hollowed-out area, and so there was nothing overwhelming about its three stories. It was simple in design and gave a strong impression of cleanliness. The entrance was on the second floor. I climbed the stairs and went in through a big glass door to find a young woman in a red dress at the reception desk. I gave her my name and said I had been instructed to ask for Dr. Ishida. She smiled and gestured towards a brown sofa, suggesting in low tones that I wait there for the doctor to come. Then she dialed a number. I lowered my rucksack from my back, sank down into the deep cushions of the sofa, and surveyed the place. It was a clean, pleasant lobby with ornamental potted plants, tasteful abstract paintings, and a polished floor. As I waited, I kept my eyes on the floor's reflection of my shoes. At one point, the receptionist assured me, "The doctor will be here soon." I nodded. What an incredibly quiet place. There were no sounds of any kind. It was as though everyone were taking a siesta. People, animals, insects, plants must all be sound asleep, I thought. It was such a quiet afternoon. Before long, though, I heard the soft padding of rubber soles, and a mature, bristly-haired woman appeared. She swept across the lobby, sat down next to me, crossed her legs, and took my hand. Instead of just shaking it, she turned my hand over, examining it front and back. You haven't played a musical instrument. At least not for some years now, have you? Were the first words out of her mouth. No, I said, taken aback. You're right. I can tell from your hands, she said with a smile. There was something almost mysterious about this woman. Her face had lots of wrinkles. These were the first thing to catch your eye. But they didn't make her look old. Instead, they emphasized a certain youthfulness in her that transcended age. The wrinkles belonged where they were, as if they had been part of her face since birth. When she smiled, the wrinkles smiled with her. When she frowned, the wrinkles frowned too. And when she was neither smiling nor frowning, the wrinkles lay scattered over her face in a strangely warm, ironic way. Here was a woman in her late 30s who seemed not merely a nice person, but whose niceness drew you to her. I liked her from the moment I saw her. Wildly chopped, her hair stuck out in patches, and the fringe lay crooked against her forehead. But the style suited her perfectly. She wore a blue work shirt over a white t-shirt, baggy cream-colored cotton trousers, and tennis shoes. Long and slim, she had almost no breasts. Her lips moved constantly to one side in a kind of ironic curl, and the wrinkles at the corners of her eyes moved in tiny twitches. She looked like a kindly skilled, but somewhat world-weary female carpenter. Chin drawn in, and lips curled, she took some time to look me over from head to toe. I imagined that any minute now she was going to whip out her tape measure and start measuring me everywhere. "Can you play an instrument?" she asked. "Sorry, no," I said. "Too bad," she said. "It would have been fun." "I suppose so," I said. "Why all this talk about musical instruments?" She took a pack of seven stars from her breast pocket, put one between her lips, lit it with a lighter, and began puffing away with obvious pleasure. "It crossed my mind that I should tell you about this place, Mr. Watanabe, wasn't it? Before you see Nako. So I arranged for the two of us to have this little talk. Ami Hostel is kind of unusual. You might find it a little confusing without any background knowledge. I'm right, aren't I, in supposing that you don't know anything about this place?" "Almost nothing." "Well then, first of all," she began, then snapped her fingers. "Come to think of it, have you had lunch? I'll bet you're hungry." "You're right, I am." "Come with me then. We can talk over food in the dining hall. Lunchtime is over, but if we go now, they can still make us something." She took the lead, hurrying down a corridor and a flight of stairs to the first-floor dining hall. It was a large room, with enough space for perhaps 200 people. But only half was in use, the other half partitioned off, like a resort hotel out of season. The day's menu listed a potato stew with noodles, salad, orange juice, and bread. The vegetables turned out to be as delicious as Naoko had said in her letter, and I finished everything on my plate. "You obviously enjoy your food," said my female companion. "It's wonderful," I said. "Plus, I've hardly eaten anything all day." "You're welcome to mine if you like. I'm full. Here, go ahead." "I will, if you really don't want it. I've got a small stomach. It doesn't hold much. I make up for what I'm missing with cigarettes." She lit another seven star. "Oh, by the way, you can call me Reiko. Everybody does." Reiko seemed to derive great pleasure from watching me while I ate the potato stew she had hardly touched and munched on her bread. "Are you Naoko's doctor?" I asked. "Me? Naoko's doctor?" She screwed up her face. "What makes you think I'm a doctor?" "They told me to ask for Dr. Ishida." "Oh, I get it. No, no, no. I teach music here. It's a kind of therapy for some patients. So for fun they call me the music doctor, and sometimes Dr. Ishida. But I'm just another patient. I've been here 7 years. I work as a music teacher and help out in the office, so it's hard to tell anymore whether I'm a patient or staff. Didn't Naoko tell you about me? I shook my head. That's strange,
said Reiko.
I'm Naoko's roommate. I like living with her. We talk about all kinds of things, including you.
What about me?
Well, first I have to tell you about this place,
said Reiko,
ignoring my question. The first thing you ought to know is that this is no ordinary hospital. It's not so much for treatment as for convalescence. We do have a few doctors, of course, and they give hourly sessions. But they're just checking people's conditions, taking their temperature and things like that, not administering treatments as in an ordinary hospital. There are no bars on the windows here, and the gate is always wide open. People enter and leave voluntarily. You have to be suited to that kind of convalescence to be admitted here in the first place. In some cases, people who need specialized therapy end up going to a specialized hospital. Okay so far?
I think so, I said. But what does this convalescence consist of? Can you give me a concrete example?
Reiko exhaled a cloud of smoke and drank what was left of her orange juice. Just living here is the convalescence, she said. A regular routine, exercise, isolation from the outside world, clean air, quiet. Our farmland makes us practically self-sufficient. There's no TV or radio. We're like one of those commune places you hear so much about. Of course, one thing different from a commune is that it costs a bundle to get in here.
A bundle?
Well, it's not ridiculously expensive, but it's not cheap. Just look at these facilities. We've got a lot of land here, a few patients, a big staff. And in my case, I've been here a long time. True, I'm almost staff myself, so I get concessions, but still. Now, how about a cup of coffee?
I said I'd like some.
She stubbed out her cigarette and went over to the counter, where she poured out 2 cups of coffee from a warm pot and brought them back to where we were sitting. She put sugar in hers, stirred it, frowned, and took a sip.
You know, she said, this sanatorium is not a profit-making enterprise, so it can keep going without charging as much as it might have to otherwise. The land was a donation. They created a corporation for the purpose. The whole place used to be the donor's summer home about 20 years ago. You saw the old house, I'm sure.
I said I had.
That used to be the only building on the property. It's where they did group therapy. That's how it all got started. The donor's son had a tendency towards mental illness, and a specialist recommended group therapy for him. The doctor's theory was that if you could have a group of patients living out in the country, helping each other with physical labor, and have a doctor for advice and checkups, you could cure certain kinds of sickness. They tried it, and the operation grew and was incorporated. And they put more land under cultivation, and put up the main building 5 years ago.
Meaning the therapy worked?
Well, not for everything. Lots of people don't get better. But also, a lot of people who couldn't be helped anywhere else managed a complete recovery here. The best thing about this place is the way everybody helps everybody else. Everybody knows they're flawed in some way, and so they try to help each other. Other places don't work that way, unfortunately. Doctors are doctors and patients are patients. The patient looks for help to the doctor, and the doctor gives his help to the patient. Here, though, we all help each other. We're all each other's mirrors, and the doctors are part of us. They watch us from the sidelines, and they slip in to help us if they see we need something. But it sometimes happens that we help them. Sometimes we're better at something than they are. For example,
I'm teaching one doctor to play the piano, and another patient is teaching a nurse French. That kind of thing. Patients with problems like ours are often blessed with special abilities. So everyone here is equal. Patients, staff, and you. You're one of us while you're in here. So I help you, and you help me.
Reiko smiled, gently flexing every wrinkle on her face. You help Naoko, and Naoko helps you.
What should I do, then? Give me an example. First, you decide that you want to help, and that you need to be helped by the other person. Then you are totally honest. You will not lie. You will not gloss over anything. You will not cover up anything that might prove embarrassing to you. That's all there is to it.
I'll try, I said. But tell me, Reiko, why have you been in here for 7 years?
Talking with you like this, I can't believe there's anything wrong with you.
Not while the sun's up, she said with a somber look. But when night comes, I start drooling and rolling on the floor.
Really?
Don't be ridiculous, I'm kidding, she said, shaking her head with a look of disgust.
I'm completely well, for now at least. I stay here because I enjoy helping other people get well, teaching music, growing vegetables. I like it here. We're all more or less friends. Compared to that, what have I got in the outside world? I'm 38 going on 40. I'm not like Naoko. There's nobody waiting for me to get out, no family to take me back. I don't have any work to speak of, and almost no friends. And after 7 years, I don't know what's going on out there. Oh, I'll read a paper in the library every once in a while, but I haven't set foot outside this property all that time. I wouldn't know what to do if I left.
But maybe a new world would open up for you, I said. It's worth a try, don't you think?
You may be right, she said, turning her cigarette lighter over and over in her hand. But I've got my own set of problems. I can tell you all about them sometime if you like.
I nodded in response. And Naoko, I said, is she any better?
We think so. She was pretty confused at first, and we had our doubts for a while. But she's calmed down now, and improved to the point where she's able to express herself verbally. She's definitely heading in the right direction. But she should have received treatment a lot earlier. Her symptoms were already apparent from the time that boyfriend of hers, Kazuki, killed himself. Her family should have seen it, and she herself should have realized that something was wrong. Of course, things weren't right at home, either.
They weren't, I shot back.
You didn't know?
Reiko seemed more surprised than I was.
I shook my head. I'd better let Naoko tell you about that herself. She's ready for some honest talk with you.
Reiko gave her coffee another stir and took a sip.
There's one more thing you need to know, she said. According to the rules here, you and Naoko will not be allowed to be alone together. Visitors can't be alone with patients. An observer always has to be present, which in this case means me. I'm sorry, but you'll just have to put up with me, okay?
Okay, I said with a smile.
But still, she said, the two of you can talk about anything you'd like. Forget I'm there. I know pretty much everything there is to know about you and Naoko.
Everything?
Pretty much. We have these group sessions, you know, so we learn a lot about each other. Plus, Naoko and I talk about everything. We don't have many secrets here.
I looked at Reiko as I drank my coffee.
To tell you the truth, I said, I'm confused. I still don't know whether what I did to Naoko in Tokyo was the right thing to do or not. I've been thinking about it this whole time, but I still don't know.
And neither do I, said Reiko,
and neither does Naoko.
That's something the two of you will have to decide for yourselves. See what I mean? Whatever happened, the two of you can turn it in the right direction, if you can reach some kind of mutual understanding. Maybe once you've got that taken care of, you can go back and think about whether what happened was the right thing or not. What do you say? I nodded. I think the three of us can help each other. You and Naoko and I, if we really want to, and if we're really honest. It can be incredibly effective when three people work at it like that. How long can you stay? Well, I'd like to get back to Tokyo by early evening the day after tomorrow. I have to work, and I've got a German exam on Thursday.
Good, she said, so you can stay with us. That way it won't cost you anything, and you can talk without having to worry about the time.
With us? I asked.
Naoko and me, of course, said Reiko.
We have a separate bedroom, and there's a sofa bed in the living room, so you'll be able to sleep fine. Don't worry.
Do they allow that? I asked. Can a male visitor stay in a woman's room?
I don't suppose you're going to come in and rape us in the middle of the night.
Don't be silly.
So there's no problem, then. Stay in our place, and we can have some nice long talks. That would be the best thing. Then we can really understand each other. And I can play my guitar for you. I'm pretty good, you know.
Are you sure I'm not going to be in the way? Reiko put her third seven star between her lips and lit it after screwing up the corner of her mouth.
Naoko and I have already discussed this. The two of us together are giving you a personal invitation to stay with us. Don't you think you should just politely accept?
Of course. I'll be glad to.
Reiko deepened the wrinkles at the corners of her eyes and looked at me for a time.
You've got this funny way of talking, she said.
Don't tell me you're trying to imitate that boy in Catcher in the Rye.
No way, I said with a smile.
Reiko smiled too, cigarette in mouth.
You are a good person, though. I can tell that much from looking at you. I can tell these things after 7 years of watching people come and go here. There are people who can open their hearts and people who can't. You're one of the ones who can. Or, more precisely, you can if you want to.
What happens when people open their hearts?
Reiko clasped her hands together on the table,
cigarette dangling from her lips. She was enjoying this.
They get better, she said.
Ash dropped onto the table, but she seemed not to notice.
Reiko and I left the main building, crossed a hill, and passed by a pool, some tennis courts, and a basketball court. Two men, one thin and middle-aged, the other young and fat, were on a tennis court. Both used their rackets well. But to me, the game they were playing could not have been tennis. It seemed as if the two of them had a special interest in the bounce of tennis balls and were doing research in that area. They slammed the ball back and forth with a kind of strange concentration. Both were drenched in sweat. The young man, in the end of the court closer to us, noticed Reiko and came over. They exchanged a few words, smiling. Near the court, a man with no expression on his face was using a large mower to cut the grass. Moving on, we came to a patch of woods, where some 15 or 20 neat little cottages stood at some distance from each other. The same kind of yellow bike the gatekeeper had been riding was parked at the entrance to almost every house.
Staff members and their families live here, said Reiko.
We have just about everything we need without going to the city, she said, as we walked along. Where food is concerned, as I said before, we're practically self-sufficient. We get eggs from our own chicken coop. We have books and records and exercise facilities, our own convenience store, and every week barbers and beauticians come to visit. We even have films at weekends. Anything special we need, we can ask a staff member to buy for us in town. Clothing we order from catalogs. Living here is no problem. But you can't go into town.
No, that we can't do.
Of course, if there's something special, like we have to go to the dentist or something, that's another matter. But as a rule, we can't go into town. Each person is completely free to leave this place. But once you've left, you can't come back. You burn your bridges. You can't go off for a couple of days in town and expect to come back. It only stands to reason, though. Everybody would be coming and going.
Beyond the trees, we came to a gentle slope along which, at irregular intervals, was a row of two-story wooden houses that had something odd about them. What made them look strange, it's hard to say. But that was the first thing I felt when I saw them. My reaction was a lot like what we feel when we see unreality painted in a pleasant way. It occurred to me that this was what you might get if Walt Disney did an animated version of a Munch painting. All the houses were exactly the same shape and color, nearly cubical, in perfect left-to-right symmetry, with big front doors and lots of windows. The road twisted its way among them like the artificial practice course of a driving school. There was a well-manicured flowering shrubbery in front of every house. The place was deserted, and curtains covered all the windows.
This is called Area C. The women live here. Us. There are 10 houses, each containing 4 units, 2 people per unit. That's 80 people altogether. But at the moment, there are only 32 of us.
Quiet, isn't it?
Well, there's nobody here now, Reiko said. I've been given special permission to move around freely like this, but everyone else is off pursuing their individual schedules. Some are exercising, some are gardening, some are in group therapy, some are out gathering wild plants. Each person makes up his or her own schedule. Let's see. What's Naoko doing now? I think she was supposed to be working on new paint and wallpaper. I forget. There are a few jobs like that that don't finish till 5.
Reiko walked into the building marked C7, climbed the stairs at the far end of the hallway, and opened the door on the right, which was unlocked. She showed me around the flat, a pleasant, if plain, 4-room unit, living room, bedroom, kitchen, and bath. It had no extra furniture or unnecessary decoration, but neither was the place severe. There was nothing special about it, but being there was kind of like being with Reiko. You could relax and let the tension leave your body. The living room had a sofa, a table, and a rocking chair. Another table stood in the kitchen. Both tables had large ashtrays on them. The bedroom had 2 beds, 2 desks, and a closet. A small night table stood between the beds with a reading lamp on top and a paperback turned face down. The kitchen had a small electric cooker that matched the fridge and was equipped for simple cooking. No bath, just a shower. But it's pretty impressive, wouldn't you say? Bath and laundry facilities are communal.
It's almost too impressive. My dorm room has a ceiling and a window.
Ah, but you haven't seen the winters here, said Reiko, touching my back to guide me to the sofa and sitting down next to me. They're long and harsh. Nothing but snow and snow and more snow everywhere you look. It gets damp and chills you to the bone. We spend the winters shoveling snow. Mostly you stay inside where it's warm and listen to music or talk or knit. If you didn't have this much space, you'd suffocate. You'll see if you come here in the winter.
Reiko gave a deep sigh, as if picturing wintertime, then folded her hands on her knees.
This will be your bed, she said, patting the sofa. We'll sleep in the bedroom, and you'll sleep here. You should be all right, don't you think?
I'm sure I'll be fine.
So that settles it, said Reiko. We'll be back around 5. Naoko and I both have things to do until then. Do you mind staying here alone?
Not at all. I'll study my German.
When Reiko left, I stretched out on the sofa and closed my eyes. I lay there steeping myself in the silence when, out of nowhere, I thought of the time Kazuki and I went on a motorbike ride. That had been autumn, too, I realized. Autumn, how many years ago? Yes, 4. I recalled the smell of Kazuki's leather jacket and the racket made by that red Yamaha 125cc bike. We went to a spot far down the coast and came back the same evening, exhausted. Nothing special happened on the way, but I remembered it well. The sharp autumn wind moaned in my ears, and looking up at the sky, my hands clutching Kazuki's jacket, I felt as if I might be swept into outer space. I lay there for a long time, letting my mind wander from one memory to another. For some strange reason, lying in this room seemed to bring back old memories that I had rarely, if ever, recalled before. Some of them were pleasant, but others carried a trace of sadness. How long did this go on? I was so immersed in that torrent of memory, and it was a torrent, like a spring gushing out of the rocks, that I failed to notice Naoko quietly open the door and come in. I opened my eyes, and there she was. I raised my head and looked into her eyes for a time. She was sitting on the arm of the sofa, looking at me. At first I thought she might be an image spun into existence by my own memories. But it was the real Naoko. "Sleeping," she whispered. "No," I said, "just thinking." I sat up and asked, "How are you?" "I'm good," she said, with a little smile like a pale, distant scene. "I don't have much time, though. I'm not supposed to be here now. I just got away for a minute, and I have to go back right away. Don't you hate my hair?" "Not at all," I said. "It's cute." Her hair was in a simple schoolgirl style, with one side held in place with a hair slide the way she used to have it in the old days. It suited her very well, as if she had always worn it that way. She looked like one of the beautiful little girls you see in woodblock prints from the Middle Ages. "It's such a pain. I have Reiko cut it for me." "Do you really think it's cute?" "Really. My mother hates it." She opened the hair slide, let the hair hang down, smoothed it with her fingers, and closed the hair slide again. It was shaped like a butterfly. "I wanted to see you alone before the three of us get together. Not that I had anything special to say. I just wanted to see your face and get used to having you here. Otherwise, I'd have trouble getting to know you again. I'm so bad with people." "Well," I asked, "is it working?" "A little," she said, touching her hair slide again. "But time's up. I've got to go." I nodded. "Toru," she began, "I really want to thank you for coming to see me. It makes me very happy. But if being here is any kind of burden to you, you shouldn't hesitate to tell me so. This is a special place, and it has a special system, and some people can't get into it. So if you feel like that, please be honest and let me know. I won't be crushed. We're honest with each other here. We tell each other all kinds of things with complete honesty." "I'll tell you," I said. "I'll be honest." Naoko sat down and leaned against me on the sofa. When I put my arm around her, she rested her head on my shoulder and pressed her face to my neck. She stayed like that for a time, almost as if she were taking my temperature. Holding her, I felt warm in the chest. After a short while, she stood up without saying a word and went out through the door as quietly as she had come in. With Naoko gone, I went to sleep on the sofa. I hadn't intended to do so, but I fell into the kind of deep sleep I had not had for a long time, filled with the sense of Naoko's presence.
In the kitchen were the dishes Naoko used. In the bathroom was the toothbrush Naoko used. And in the bedroom was the bed in which Naoko slept. Sleeping soundly in this flat of hers, I wrung the fatigue from every cell of my body, drop by drop. I dreamed of a butterfly dancing in the half-light. When I awoke again, the hands of my watch were pointing to 4:35. The light had changed. The wind had died. The shapes of the clouds were different. I had sweated in my sleep, so I dried my face with a small towel from my rucksack and put on a fresh vest. Going to the kitchen, I drank some water and stood there looking through the window over the sink. I was facing a window in the building opposite, on the inside of which hung several paper cutouts, a bird, a cloud, a cow, a cat, all in skillful silhouette and joined together. As before, there was no sign of anyone about, and there were no sounds of any kind. I felt as if I were living alone in an extremely well-cared-for ruin. People started coming back to Area C a little after 5. Looking out of the kitchen window, I saw 3 women passing below. All wore hats that prevented me from telling their ages, but judging from their voices, they were not very young. Shortly after they had disappeared around a corner, 4 more women appeared from the same direction, and, like the first group, disappeared around the same corner. An evening mood hung over everything. From the living room window I could see trees and a line of hills. Above the ridge floated a border of pale sunlight. Naoko and Reiko came back together at 5:30. Naoko and I exchanged proper greetings, as if meeting for the first time. She seemed truly embarrassed. Reiko noticed the book I had been reading and asked what it was. Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, I told her. "How could you bring a book like that to a place like this?" she demanded. She was right, of course. Reiko then made coffee for the 3 of us. I told Naoko about Stormtrooper's sudden disappearance, and about the last day I saw him when he gave me the Firefly. "I'm so sorry he's gone," she said. "I wanted to hear more stories about him." Reiko asked who Stormtrooper was, so I told her about his antics and got a big laugh from her. The world was at peace and filled with laughter as long as Stormtrooper stories were being told. At 6, we went to the dining hall in the main building for supper. Naoko and I had fried fish with green salad, boiled vegetables, rice, and miso soup. Reiko limited herself to pasta salad and coffee, followed by another cigarette. "You don't need to eat as much as you get older," she said, by way of explanation. Some 20 other people were there in the dining hall. A few newcomers arrived as we ate. Meanwhile, some others left. Aside from the variety in people's ages, the scene looked pretty much like that of the dining hall in my dormitory. Where it differed was the uniform volume at which people conversed. There were no loud voices and no whispers. No one laughing out loud or crying out in shock. No one yelling with exaggerated gestures. Nothing but quiet conversations, all carrying on at the same level. People were eating in groups of 3 to 5, each with a single speaker, to whom the others would listen with nods and grunts of interest. And when that person had finished speaking, the next would take up the conversation. I could not tell what they were saying, but the way they said it reminded me of the strange tennis game I had seen at noon. I wondered if Naoko spoke like this when she was with them, and, strangely enough, I felt a twinge of loneliness mixed with jealousy. At the table behind me, a balding man in white with the authentic air of a doctor was holding forth to a nervous-looking young man in glasses and a squirrel-faced woman of middle age on the effects of weightlessness on the secretion of gastric juices. The 2 listened with an occasional, "My goodness," or, "Really?"
But the longer I listened to the balding man's style of speaking, the less certain I became that, even in his white coat, he was really a doctor. No one in the dining hall paid me any special attention. No one stared, or even seemed to notice I was there. My presence must have been an entirely natural event. Just once, though, the man in white spun around and asked me, "How long will you be staying?"
"Two nights," I said. "I'll be leaving on Wednesday."
"It's nice here this time of year, isn't it? But come again in winter. It's really nice when everything's white."
"Naoko may be out of here by the time it snows," said Reiko to the man.
"True, but still, the winter's really nice,"
he repeated with a somber expression. I felt increasingly unsure as to whether or not he was a doctor.
"What do you people talk about?" I asked Reiko, who seemed to not quite follow me.
"What do we talk about?"
"Just ordinary things. What happened that day, or books we've read, or tomorrow's weather, you know."
"Don't tell me you're wondering if people jump to their feet and shout stuff like, 'It'll rain tomorrow if a polar bear eats the stars tonight.'"
"No, no, of course not," I said. "I was just wondering what all these quiet conversations were about."
"It's a quiet place, so people talk quietly," said Naoko. She made a neat pile of fish bones at the edge of her plate and dabbed at her mouth with a handkerchief. "There's no need to raise your voice here. You don't have to convince anybody of anything, and you don't have to attract anyone's attention."
"I guess not," I said. But as I ate my meal in those quiet surroundings, I was surprised to find myself missing the hum of people. I wanted to hear laughter, and people shouting for no reason, and saying overblown things. That was just the kind of noise I had become weary of in recent months, but sitting here eating fish in this unnaturally quiet room, I couldn't relax. The dining hall had all the atmosphere of a specialized machine tool trade fair. People with a strong interest in a specialist field came together in a specific place and exchanged information understood only by themselves. Back in the room after supper, Naoko and Reiko announced that they would be going to the Area C communal bath, and that if I didn't mind having just a shower, I could use the one in their bathroom.
"I would do that," I said, and after they were gone, I undressed, showered, and washed my hair. I found a Bill Evans album in the bookcase, and was listening to it while drying my hair, when I realized that it was the record I had played in Naoko's room on the night of her birthday. The night she cried, and I took her in my arms. That had been only 6 months ago, but it felt like something from a much remoter past. Maybe it felt that way because I had thought about it so often. Too often, to the point where it had distorted my sense of time. The moon was so bright. I turned the lights off and stretched out on the sofa to listen to Bill Evans' piano. Streaming in through the window, the moonlight cast long shadows and splashed the walls with a touch of diluted Indian ink. I took a thin metal flask from my rucksack, let my mouth fill with the brandy it contained, allowed the warmth to move slowly down my throat to my stomach, and from there felt it spreading to every extremity. After a final sip, I closed the flask and returned it to my rucksack. Now the moonlight seemed to be swaying with the music. 20 minutes later, Naoko and Reiko came back from the bath.
"Oh, it was so dark here we thought you had packed your bags and gone back to Tokyo," exclaimed Reiko.
"No way," I said. "I hadn't seen such a bright moon for years. I wanted to look at it with the lights off."
"It's lovely, though," said Naoko. "Reiko, do we still have those candles from the last power cut?"
"Probably in a kitchen drawer." Naoko brought a large white candle from the kitchen. I lit it, dripped a little wax into a plate, and stood it up. Reiko used the flame to light a cigarette.
As the three of us sat facing the candle amid these hushed surroundings, it began to seem as if we were the only ones left on some far edge of the world. The still shadows of the moonlight and the swaying shadows of the candlelight met and melded on the white walls of the flat. Naoko and I sat next to each other on the sofa, and Reiko settled into the rocking chair facing us.
"How about some wine?"
Reiko asked me. "You're allowed to drink?" I asked with some surprise.
"Well, not really," said Reiko, scratching an earlobe with a hint of embarrassment. "But they pretty much let it go, if it's just wine or beer and you don't drink too much. I've got a friend on the staff who buys me a little now and then."
"We have our drinking parties," said Naoko with a mischievous air. "Just the two of us."
"That's nice," I said. Reiko took a bottle of white wine from the fridge, opened it with a corkscrew, and brought three glasses. The wine had a clear, delicious flavor that seemed almost homemade. When the record ended, Reiko brought out a guitar from under her bed, and after tuning it with a look of fondness for the instrument, she began to play a slow Bach fugue. She missed her fingering every now and then, but it was real Bach, with real feeling, warm, intimate, and filled with the joy of performance.
"I started playing the guitar here," said Reiko. "There are no pianos in the rooms, of course. I'm self-taught, and I don't have guitar hands, so I'll never get very good. But I really love the instrument. It's small and simple and easy, kind of like a warm little room."
She played one more short Bach piece, something from a suite. Eyes on the candle flame, sipping wine, listening to Reiko's Bach, I felt the tension inside me slipping away. When Reiko ended the Bach, Naoko asked her to play a Beatles song.
"Request time," said Reiko, winking at me. "She makes me play Beatles every day, like I'm her music slave."
Despite her protest, Reiko played a fine Michelle.
"That's a good one," she said. "I really like that song."
She took a sip of wine and puffed her cigarette.
"It makes me feel like I'm in a big meadow in a soft rain."
Then she played Nowhere Man and Julia. Now and then as she played, she would close her eyes and shake her head. Afterwards, she would return to the wine and the cigarette.
"Play Norwegian Wood," said Naoko.
Reiko brought a porcelain beckoning cat from the kitchen. It was a coin bank, and Naoko dropped a 100-yen piece from her purse into its slot. "What's this all about?" I asked.
"It's a rule," said Naoko. "When I request Norwegian Wood, I have to put 100 yen into the bank. It's my favorite, so I make a point of paying for it. I make a request when I really want to hear it.
And that way I get my cigarette money," said Reiko.
Reiko gave her fingers a good flexing and then played Norwegian Wood. Again she played with real feeling, but never allowed it to become sentimental. I took a 100-yen coin from my pocket and dropped it into the bank.
"Thank you," said Reiko, with a sweet smile.
"That song can make me feel so sad," said Naoko. "I don't know. I guess I imagine myself wandering in a deep wood. I'm all alone and it's cold and dark, and nobody comes to save me. That's why Reiko never plays it unless I request it."
"Sounds like Casablanca," Reiko said with a laugh.
She followed Norwegian Wood with a few bossa novas while I kept my eyes on Naoko. As she had said in her letter, she looked healthier than before. Suntanned, her body firm from exercise and outdoor work. Her eyes were the same deep, clear pools they had always been, and her small lips still trembled shyly. But overall, her beauty had begun to change to that of a mature woman. Almost gone now was the sharp edge, the chilling sharpness of a thin blade that could be glimpsed in the shadows of her beauty.
in place of which there now hovered a uniquely soothing, quiet calm. I felt moved by this new, gentle beauty of hers, and amazed to think that a woman could change so much in the